take identity seriously, because most of the times the hackers are not sitting there on green screen hacking like they did in the Matrix or in the movies. They're literally just phishing an account away from you and they're logging in. They're not even hacking. You're giving them the password.
Hello and welcome back to the Angels Exits and Acquisitions Podcast. My name is Jeff Barnes. I'll be your host today. Today we spoke with Nim Nataraja, who is out of Toronto, Canada, and has done Toronto, Ontario, Canada, for those of you in Canada. And we talked a lot about how to make businesses investable, the things that entrepreneurs should be looking out for when it comes to risk mitigation factors, specifically around cybersecurity and technology risks, data protection, things like that. Because at the end of the day, no one wants to invest in a company that is prone to risk and will be put out of business if they have a data breach or security breach. So pay attention, take notes, lots of great actionable items that you should be doing as a result of this if you're looking to raise capital or invest in companies.
Welcome to Angels, Exits, and Acquisitions, the place to learn how to fund, scale, exit, and massively profit as an angel investor or entrepreneur. Brought to you by the Angel Investors Network. And now, here's your host, Jeff Barnes.
Hello and welcome again to another episode of Angels, Exits, and Acquisitions. My name is Jeff Barnes. I'm your host today. And today we are joined by Toronto. I don't know if you're a native, but you're living in Toronto right now. Nim Nataraja. Nim, how are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me, Jeff. Very excited to be here.
Yeah, talk absolutely. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. We were just talking before we started recording here about some of the things that you help companies with, entrepreneurs specifically, when it comes to raising capital and whatnot. But before we get into all of those details, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself, give them a little bit of background, and then how you got to where you are today.
Fantastic. Yeah, I've been doing this for about 30 years, Jeff. I've been in the technology, cybersecurity, and digital transformation space. Have one or two exits under my belt. And I find that my purpose is to bring sort of technology and security to companies, and that my purpose and my passion intersect, because I really like to help people. And I find that being able to be an advisor, being able to be a leader in the security space, also help guide people and technology companies to do things securely and scale their businesses efficiently.
Awesome. So, yeah, you said you had a couple of exits early on. You know, I find that with most entrepreneurs, when they get going, their passion may be teaching other people, but when we're early in our careers, we don't necessarily have, you know, the expertise, the experience, or so on. But once you have an exit, you definitely have that. So, you know, talk to us a little bit about what that process was for you of scaling up a company to an eventual exit. Like, how did that shift maybe your outlook on certain things in life?
You know, everything is scary until you do it, right? I think you must begin every journey with an end in mind. And as a leader, you know, understand what a happy sort of end looks like and understand what a bad end looks like. But in your mind, you're obviously always thinking positive and going towards the right thing. But sometimes it's okay to say, hey, you know what? This isn't going the way we're going. Like, maybe we should do a little stop loss here and reframe and reconnect. In my case, I was fortunate that, you know, both exits were successful. One was a cybersecurity services company. Another one was a training company. And that led me to believe, like, hey, you know, I've made all these mistakes. I've learned all these valuable lessons. How can I share that with others in order to help them grow and get better and kind of avoid some of the common pitfalls that I fell into?
Yeah, absolutely. And with those exits, were those the exits you had planned in the very beginning? Because I love what you just said. You start with the end in mind. And I feel that most entrepreneurs, most business owners in general, they're literally looking out maybe a week or a month in advance. They're not looking out years or decades in advance. So yeah. I'm curious how the exit that you experienced lined up or maybe didn't with the one that you were originally thinking of when you first started.
I think that's a great question, because the first one was definitely was something that we were lining up for, and it worked out fantastic. The second one, not so much. I think it was more of a shotgun clause, because it made sense that the people change, companies change, people are the culture of every company. And when the team that you're delivering something with no longer aligns with you, it is a difficult choice as an entrepreneur to say, hey, you know what, this isn't for me anymore, and step back. And planning for those vehicles to be in your contracts, in your agreements, is fundamental, because you might start on a journey with a partnership, but that might not always work correctly. That might not always align with who you are and you've become, or who they are and who they've become. And, you know, sometimes, you know, my example of saying understanding what the future is and always begin with an exit in mind, that means that you're provisioning contracts, provisioning shares, provisioning vehicles in order to scale, but also to exit if needed.
So how do you plan for that, especially early on? I know a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with having a cap table. A lot of them don't understand how to structure a cap table properly or the different types of shares and things like that. So when you're getting your company up and running and you're looking at, here's the exit I want, but of course there's risk mitigation factors and contingency plans along the way. How do we make sure we can get there? Or if we don't get there, you know, like you said, it's almost like the divorce clause, right? Like, how do we go our separate ways? And how do you have that conversation with a partner or co-founder?
You know, I think that is a very get real conversation, right? It's almost like having that prenup conversation in a real wedding situation. So you kind of have to say, look, like, this is for you and this is to me and this is to protect the business and our idea. We have to focus on what's right for the company. If we feel like, you know, things have changed and what's right is a little different, we need to have provisions in our contracts to make that a success for everybody, right? And these are uncomfortable conversations. And how do you get to having these uncomfortable conversations is surround yourself with a good mentor and a good advisory board and a really good lawyer. Because some of the conversations that you're afraid to bring up, your mentor, your counsel, and your board of advisors might bring it up to all of you at the same time by saying, hey, have you guys talked about this yet? And all of a sudden you're like, no, we actually haven't. And then they'll provide that insight for you to step away and have that conversation and make that icebreaker a little less awkward.
I love that. And I love the way you phrase that, right? When you have a good advisory team or board of directors, hopefully they're not telling you as the founder or CEO what to do, right? Now, it's different if you're a big company and you have a board of directors already in place and they hire the CEO, that's different. But when it's your company, you want advisors who are going to ask you questions, not necessarily tell you, here's what you need to do, right?
Yes.
They're going to ask you, have you explored this? Have you thought about that? Like you just said, have you guys had that conversation yet? And they might ask, well, why would I need to? That's where a good advisor comes in. So I love that you phrased it that way. So when it comes to, you know, getting a company up and running, right? We always talk that there's different types of companies. There's your small businesses that are also kind of lifestyle businesses. They are designed to support the founders and the owners of the company. And then you have these entrepreneurial ventures, which are designed to scale exponentially, right? And we always get a lot of these companies coming in that are asking us for help with raising capital. And we tell them, you know, you do not have a company worth raising capital for, right? You have a small business venture. You're not looking to raise capital. You're looking for a partner, maybe somebody that can come in and help you with the cost, but you're not looking to raise capital. On the other hand, a company that might go to 9-figure, 10-figure valuation in the next 5 to 10 years, they might need to raise capital and it might make a lot of sense. But so many companies don't understand that the process of raising capital. We spend a lot of time working with that in our workshops, our training and coaching and all that. But you have a really specific process when it comes to, or maybe it's not just a process, but also a philosophy behind this and then things that people need to look out for when they're raising capital. So I'd love for you to spend a few minutes and just kind of talk about that and also how you develop this process.
You know, Jeff, I always like to highlight a partner is not an investor. An investor is not an advisor. And an advisor is definitely not an operator. And creating that segregation and duty or that mindset is really difficult in the beginning because you're starting out, you got a cool idea, it's your baby, you got to go. And you run into somebody who has a really cool vibe and understands and seems to be passionate about what, you know, same thing you are. And the first thing that comes into mind is, hey, do you want to be my co-founder, Jeff? This is great. But that literally is as important as a marriage proposal. And you have to be very careful who you're inviting into that, the founder shares of the company, and making sure that you protect that in every way possible. The other challenge that I find people run into is they walk into, you know, you're literally on the street and, you know, somebody says, hey, I really like your, you know, what you're doing here. I have some advice for you. I'd like to be on your board. And all of a sudden they have a 250,000 shares and they're sitting on your board. But you have another due diligence behind saying, is this the right person to advise my company, to advise my team, to advise my leadership, and to advise me? Are they going to guide my company? And sometimes these advisors are picked based on the fact that they're a key industry influencer. A key influencer becomes an advisor because they can drive sales. That doesn't mean they're a good advisor. That means they're probably just a good key influencer and there's a place for them. That doesn't make them owners of the company. So surround yourself with the right people so that they're available for you at the right time. And be very careful on how you select them. So our process goes around making sure in order to make a company investable, how do we help pick the right people to sit at that table and facilitate that process? But then how do you allow your company to scale securely? Because it has as much to do with the right people to enable your business as the process, policy, procedure, and technology to scale your business. More often than not, we find 75% of startups fail within 90 days of going live because they worked on alpha, they made it beta, but when they brought it to market, it was still built on beta backend. And it wasn't secure, it couldn't stand the attack of the first set of attackers that they got their hands on. So scaling your business securely or protecting your investment or securing your investment is really important. I'm also finding that a lot of venture capital, private equity firms are using similar checklists to ask curious questions on the investability of the platform now that they weren't doing before. More in the past, it was more of a business stress test, a product stress test, than a security and survivability stress test. So, you know, we help companies overcome those challenges and pass those stress tests so that they can stay successful and relevant.
So what do you think has been the big shift in that? I mean, there's been a lot of cybersecurity attacks in the last, you know, decade, two decades, and we've seen massive companies almost brought to their knees as a result of some of these things, right? Whether it's privacy or data breaches or things like that. You know, are you seeing that is something that, you know, industry experts, you know, cybersecurity people are getting involved a lot more at the early stage rather than just the Fortune level? Because, you know, the Fortune 500 level, of course, there's a lot of need for that. And most startups, most founders won't even think about the security or the infrastructure of their technology until much further along because they're just busy building.
You know, if you're raising a seed round and you don't have a security advisor or security leader on your company, I think you owe it to your investors to get one on board. And then if you're an investor and you're looking at giving into a seed round or a Series A round, and the conversation of security hasn't come up yet, I'd stop and ask that question, right?
So,
just from a fundamental perspective.
Right. And, you know, we talk about here at Angel Investors Network, risk mitigation factors. What are the things that are going to reduce the risk of this company succeeding so that we can hopefully achieve our exit and make a lot of money, right? Most angel investors don't make money until there's a liquidity event, right?
Yes.
And if we never make it to that liquidity event, well, we're dead in the water.
Yeah.
And so we're talking right now about making a company investable. And this is one of those big risk mitigation factors. Would you agree?
I absolutely agree. If you're not investable and I cannot prove that my investment is secure, then we are all in a little bit of trouble. You know, one of the points that I want to raise that a lot of startups lack is the awareness of security within the company as a risk mitigator, as opposed to an inconvenience. We're talking about product-centric development teams who are interested in a rapid go-to-market plan, and security is an afterthought because, one, it's probably going to cost me more and more work and more money and more time. And it's also not going to make me work as efficient. Right? As a developer, I need to have local admin access. I need to be able to do everything. I need to be empowered to do everything on this machine that I should be able to do with it without thinking of the risks that follow through with that. That's just one example.
And so what are some of those vulnerabilities that investors need to be aware of or be able to ask the questions? Like, what are those questions that they should ask? Because most investors are not, like you, really educated when it comes to these security risks. So what are some questions they should be asking of these entrepreneurs when they're, you know, looking to invest in a company?
You know, definitely starting with understanding, is there a culture of security? And chances are no. But then what are you doing to achieve it? How are you as a team moving towards that? Because that is paramount to being able to implement any other controls, is that people understand the relevance and have assigned importance and value to doing things in a secure manner and are aware of what's happening around, you know, vulnerabilities and hacks and attacks in their product, service, sector. And then data protection measures. This is something that is commonly overlooked in the surprising amount of startups, is when you ask questions like, so when your data goes from here in the app to here in your data center, is it encrypted? How is it encrypted? Or where is it going and how is it protected? And yeah, you know, we kind of use this basic stuff, or we're using this, you know, open source platform to do this and that. But data security now comes with regulatory compliance requirements that, you know, Quebec Law 25, the California Privacy Protection Act, Canada's C27, which is going to come out soon. These are all going to involve significant financial impediment to the company should there be a breach or a user raise an action of consequence because they want to get rid of their data or they're concerned about their FOI.
So how does, just really quickly on that point, you mentioned earlier that upwards of 75% of these startups will fail when they finally bring their product to market because of security-related issues. How does an entrepreneur, an investor, a company that's really early stage, how do they grapple with this? We need to get to market and we're running out of money because we have a massive burn rate. We have software development and R&D costs and all these other costs that are coming in. But security is a major issue. You know, what's sort of that approach? I mean, I can understand where somebody would say, yeah, we don't want to go to market yet until we have our security pieces fixed. But that's not really a sexy sell to a lot of investors, right? Yeah, I need $500,000 more so we can fix these security issues so that we can go to market, right? You know, how do companies grapple with that?
It's a risk-based conversation, right? So as an investor myself, when somebody says, you know what, we did an analysis and we found this report and I need another $150,000 to fix these gaps that we need to mitigate before we go live, that really is an underpinning insurance to my product that I've invested in to go to market. Now I can go back and say, well, why did you guys think of this before? Why are we talking about this now? Why is it so expensive at this point? Wouldn't it have been cheaper if you baked this into your platform? Absolutely. Yes to all of the above. But we are where we are. So if I want my $500,000 investment to stay secure in the marketplace and sell and be marketable, I have to spend another $150,000 to make it marketable. Because on the other side, the consumer is not going to buy a platform that cannot prove it's secure either, product or sales. So you kind of owe to it. And this is why in our firm, we've started working with startups and as well as the investment organizations, say, let's start with security as a foundation, a fundamental principle, so that we're not having to spend the $500,000 labor. We're not having to put security in as an afterthought. But if you start from the beginning with it in mind, then it just becomes like another part of the, you know, part of the sheetrock of building the house, right? We don't have to talk about this afterwards.
So what are some of the things that would come up in that conversation as places somebody should look? Like, be specific with me. So for example, you know, a company gets started up and they, you know, they need to build out an open API to integrate with all these different things. But in the meantime, they just connect with Zapier or Pavly or something like that, where it just sends data back and forth.
My favorite is when they use third-party products like Zapier, et cetera, and it is a hard-coded password. And it's password 123 with $2 signs for S's. Right? I mean, there are fast ways to do it. And there are wrong ways to do it, and that is fast and wrong. But there was a time and place where, yeah, we were using dummy data. We were trying to do this quickly. And We didn't go through a tokenization phase and modern authentication configuration. We just wanted to get it quick and dirty. But Zapier is a good example because that kind of an integration is a back-end integration that it's tested and it works and we know it's there. And guess what? We tend to take it for granted and forget about it. We don't go back and look at it until we get hacked or go through a security audit and somebody says, one, password in plain text, two, simple password, easily hacked. So that's just one example of many. We talked about creating the awareness of culture. We talked about, you know, being aware of data and making data-driven decisions when you're encrypting and transporting data. A fundamental one, and this is a great segue into the sort of like the third one, is weak access controls and authentication processes. Too many companies start off on, you know, personal Gmail, and they haven't turned on multi-factor authentication for those accounts. Then they move to corporate mail. Yeah, MFA's there. We're going to turn it on. It's on for some people. It's not on for everyone. These are habits that have to be stopped. If you're using an application third-party integration, go through app registration. All cloud providers have a secure way of authenticating a third-party app or your app into their cloud platform. Take identity seriously because most of the times, the hackers are not sitting there on green screen hacking like they did in The Matrix or in the movies. They're literally just phishing an account away from you and they're logging in. They're not even hacking. You're giving them the password. So take some responsibility for making sure that your password cannot be easily taken from. And that comes back to the first thing is a culture of security. So people know that, you know what, security is important. I got to pay attention to these things.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. I was working with a company and they needed me to have a domain email for them. And so I got one and logged in. They use Google Workspace and all of that. And one of the first challenges we were seeing was, hey, you guys are using like the standard, not even the business or the enterprise level. We need to get that fixed right away. Like that's a big issue. And then one of the workarounds in the meantime was, well, let's at least, you know, make sure the passwords expire every 30 days. Right. And I was like, okay, that's fair. I hate it. I hate it. Cause then all of a sudden your phone doesn't sync up properly because your passwords, you know, reset and all that, but at least it's one security measure they can put in place. What are some other things that you guys look at when you are evaluating a potential investment, like a checklist of like, okay, well, here's some of the things that we want to be looking at to see if it's investable.
Absolutely. One is making sure that there's basic security turned on. And MFA isn't, having MFA turned on alone isn't security. It's a bunch of other things. Making sure that there's encryption on the laptops. Making sure that there's conditional access so that, you know what, Jeff, when you work from Mexico, the computer's going to challenge the heck out of you when you access our systems. But when you're in the office on our network, we're going to believe that it's you sitting in your desk, because it's kind of hard to break into a physical building and pretend to be you at the same time and nobody noticing. Encryption, data at rest and data in transit, right? These are absolutely important. Patching and compliance for servers and hosts. How current is the operating system that the entire system is built on, the servers that the system is built on is running? Like, have you kept up patching? Are you making sure that you've got a process in place to make sure that when things go wrong, you're able to recover from that? So there's the whole, you know, making sure you have a proper incident response, a backup and recovery, and that these things are actually tested and validated. Like a lot of startups, you know, for the first time when we have a conversation with them, they're like, why would I have to test the backup? The backup is the backup. Like, sure, until you need it, and then you realize it's not working anymore, right? Another popular one is just asking them, what is their security budget? Like, how much do you even have security as a line item? And I would say about 1% do. Actually, that's not fair. I would say about 5% do, because now we're getting to a point in the industry and in the market and the world that security is a frontline conversation. Whereas in the past, it's always been a back end conversation, right? Yeah. Another trick question I like to ask companies is ask them about their regulatory and compliance commitments as a product or a service. And usually they'll, you know, if it's a trading platform, they're like, oh, yeah, we got IROC, we got this. Or if it's healthcare, they'll talk about HIPAA. But then you start peeling that layer. You talk about, well, what about, what identifiable data do you have? Where is that identifiable data stored? Do you know the locations in which these identifiable information is coming from and where is it going? And you start asking these questions and they realize, oh, it's not just one regulatory standard. There's like three or four of them we now have to be compliant to. And that, you know, all of this is becoming investable because it all contributes to a risk multiplier. If you don't have this, it might not be a problem now, but it's definitely going to be a problem later. And I'm banking on money later. So I have to make sure that's protected.
Well, and I think, you know, tell me if you agree with this or not, but every company is going to experience some sort of attack at some point in the future, right? It's not a question of if, but when. And so having all these things in place is vital, of course, right? Because we know that we want to protect our data. We want to protect our intellectual property. We want to protect as much as we can, right? But what are some of the things, like, does insurance play into this review as well, right? Like cybersecurity risk insurance and things like that. What are some other things beyond just like, you know, that checklist that we would want to look at, say, okay, well, here's something I would suggest you guys look into?
I 150% agree with you. It's not a matter of not, but when. And the most important attribute to getting breached is understanding what you're going to do when you get breached. And, you know, we're very good at preparing for the happy things, like when we're going to IPO, right, when we're going to get Series A, when we're going to get our seed funding. But we're never really prepared for the dark side of things when they go wrong. And it can make a huge difference, again, having those awkward conversations, having plans in place, and knowing how to respond to it. We tend to forget that bad things will happen. You will get a flat tire when you're driving on the highway, but making sure you have your auto club, your membership is current, and you know how to safely pull over and call for help, have a charged cell phone and a blanket in the car. These are just safety measures to how you're going to deal with that flat tire. You can take it one step further. You might have the skills to change it yourself, or you've got the auto club that you can call to come and change it for you. Incident response and a plan for recovery should be the basic part of any organization going into these. Insurance asks you, do you have these things? They might ask you to prove whether you have one or two of these things. Too often than not, I find that, you know, founders and the teams would gain the insurance to get it. But the problem is when you have a breach and you said that you have something, but you really don't, and they ask you to prove it and you can't, you're now at risk of not being insured.
Yep.
So, while I really like it that, you know, a small company going to market with seed funding has its directors and officers insurance, they've got errors and omissions, and they've got whatever coverage that they have for cyber. But most times when you peel that onion back, they didn't check all the correct boxes for cyber.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Nim, this is really, really valuable information for a lot of people, especially, you know, of course, in the tech space, like you were saying, you know, the medical, the health tech, you know, those types of industries are really susceptible. We live in a world now where, you know, Bitcoin and blockchain technology is ubiquitous and everybody knows about it, but they don't necessarily know the dark underbelly and the, you know, the back alley side of things. So it's really great that you've been bringing this out. Are there any other things that are on that list or that process when it comes to making a company investable that we need to cover before we wrap up here?
I would say, you know, the golden nugget from today is third-party risk. It's really easy as a organization creating a product or service that we have intention to monetize to say, hey, you know, there's a data source there. I'm going to go use that company for data source. There's a loyalty company there. I'm going to connect to that loyalty company. But a lot of times organizations are breached, I would say 90%, through vendors and third-party connections that you do not control. So even as a small company, partnering with a bigger company to get data or integrate and demonstrate value in your product or service, ask those questions on how they are protecting the system that you're connecting to and getting data from, and assess them. Ask the questions that you need to ask to feel comfortable from a security perspective. And that's even more important when you're working with an open source company, an open source platform, or smaller companies that you're partnering with in order to grow and scale. Never trust, always verify. And the number one thing you need to protect as a startup organization is your identity. And make sure you have security as a budgeted line item, or no investor is going to give you a shiny penny until they know that their risk is being protected.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great information. I love it. You know, these are things that people don't think about when it comes to raising capital or investing in companies, and part of the due diligence checklist should include these items. So really, really appreciate your time here today. Why don't you tell everybody, you know, how they can contact you or find you online?
Absolutely. My name is Nim Nataraja. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can send me an email at nim@criticalmatrix.com. And our firm is Critical Matrix and Matrix Ventures.
Awesome. Wonderful. Nim, thanks so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. And for everybody out there who is watching or listening to this, please be sure to like, subscribe, and share so we can keep sharing the message with angels, exits, and acquisitions here at Angel Investors Network. Thank you.